This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. As the holidays approach, advocates want to remind people to keep an eye on their elderly family members, neighbors, and friends. This is the time of year when being isolated can amplify feelings of loneliness, which can, in turn, lead to elder abuse or neglecting to care for oneself. Later in the show, we'll talk about that. But first, we're going to explore the current state of real estate in Southwest Florida. By most accounts, the market has recovered from the 2008 crash. Home values are back to pre-crash levels, and the trends continue to be mostly positive. But that positivity in home values can have a negative impact when rental costs and the cost of owning a home get too high for people whose income hasn't kept pace with increasing real estate market values. I'm joined now by David Cobb. He's the regional director for South Florida with Metro Study. It's a provider of market information to the housing market and other parts of the economy. David, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Hey, thank you very much.
I'm also joined in studio by Brad Dohack. He's the qualifying broker of Gulf Point Properties in Fort Myers. Brad, thanks for coming in today.
Julie, appreciate you having me.
And by phone, I'm joined by Denny Grimes from the Denny Grimes & Company. He's been selling homes in Southwest Florida for more than 30 years. Denny, thanks also for taking some time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Were you around in 2008? If so, how have you recovered from the real estate market crash? Maybe you're new to the area and you're hoping to find a home. Or you're a renter who's finding it increasingly difficult to afford your monthly payment. You can join this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So first, David Cobb, Regional Director for South Florida with Metro Study. Let's start with you. What's the overall trend right now in the residential market in Southwest Florida for new homes?
Yeah, well, there's two different scenarios. Lee and Collier are different in their housing characteristics. But if we start with Lee County, we have now on an annual basis started 2,584 homes in the planned communities that we survey. That's only 37% of the peak number that was recorded back in the fourth quarter of 2005. So as you can see, you know, we're not even back to that peak, but we are at the near 15-year average, almost 100% back to average.
So now you study mainly the new housing.
Correct.
The housing starts, I guess, is what it's considered, right?
Supply and demand, futures.
Okay. The futures. Okay. So do you think, are you foreseeing additional new homes coming online in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, our housing industry is populated by a lot of major public home builders, and they have to kind of keep feeding the gorilla and opening new projects to sustain their business plan. So we do see that. We see it becoming increasingly difficult to find good land in A locations, though, so people are moving further and further away from the core to find property that they can develop reasonably and offer homes that are affordable.
Do any of these giants ever consider rebuilding existing spaces or tearing down and starting over?
No, not in their plan.
Nope, they just always want new fresh land.
Some have gone into rental. We see some of the big publics who have built all single-family rental communities and apartments. But by and large, they stick to new housing and not remodeling.
And do you see any of these guys going towards any more affordable housing? Because there's been a big outcry for affordable housing because it kind of doesn't exist, especially down in Collier County. It's an issue. Do you see any of them moving towards that?
Oh, yes. Many of the majors have a value line, a value product line. Some of it has been introduced here in our local market to a lot of success. There's a healthy appetite out there in our market right now for affordable new homes. And when you look at the top communities in Lee and Collier, two of them in particular, Ave Maria and now River Hall, they're in the top five. These are communities that are well east of I-75. In fact, they're probably the easternmost new active communities in each respective county. And yet they're in the top list because they have homes that start, you know, $180,000, $190,000, $200,000. And you can't find that just about anywhere else.
Yeah, no. So when you're looking at Lee and Collier County and different parts of Southwest Florida, where are they building the new homes? Where are the new houses? Where do they tend to be going?
Well, Lee County, the more desirable location is the south end of the county for new homes. It's gotten expensive. So builders are now looking at where else they, you know, and the land is getting dear down there, scarce. So the two main areas are going to be out Highway 80, where River Hall is located, and also Veranda. Babcock Ranch, and then North Fort Myers and Cape Coral, where there's still some available land. I think that's going to be the future for Lee County. Collier, on the other hand, actually, they do have a lot of developable land left. It's owned by Baron Collier and Collier Enterprises in and around Ave Maria. But there's room there for up to 50,000 new homes. So you're not going to see a whole lot of housing activity in Collier along the coast or west of I-75. It's all going to be in the interior of the county.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn now to Brad Dohack. He's a realtor with Gulf Point Realty Properties in Fort Myers. So how long have you been working in real estate in Southwest Florida?
So I've actually been licensed since 2006, full-time in real estate since 2009.
So that was probably not a great time to hop in there, was it?
Yeah.
What was that like to start out?
So starting out in 2009 full-time in real estate really was I look at it as more of a blessing because it is, you know, clawing for every transaction. And what you're focused on at that point is you're focused on, you know, serving the people who are doing transactions as best as you possibly can. So, you know, while the dollar amount of each sale transaction was much lower at that time, you could provide the proper service to grow, you know, a business really from scratch.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. And plus, you know, it can't really get a whole lot worse. I mean, let's knock on wood, of course.
Yeah, that's exactly why I went into real estate to begin with. Like, it can't get any worse than this, right?
So what have you seen over the past 8 years with existing homes? Have the values just steadily increased?
It's been very steady. You know, unlike the 2007 to 2009 time frame where the price reduction was just significant year over year, since 2009 we've seen steady, and many of those years have been double digit appreciation year over year. So that's been good. Our inventory has come down significantly since that time frame, the 2008-2009 time frame. So it's been a healthy market. You know, we don't have any of the scare that was going on in the 2006 timeframe, you know, as far as the crazy prices just going up significantly.
People were buying out
contracts. Yeah. So you could write a contract and then take that paper and sell it to somebody else for $25,000. You know, that's something that would have been possible back then. And that, you know, we're not in that type of a market, thank goodness.
We're not there. So what part of the problem that got us into that 2008 has been blamed on the lending that was where people were getting mortgages that you didn't really have to have much proof of income, very little bit of money down. Has that lending changed?
Significantly.
Is it harder?
Yeah. So you could do what was called a stated income loan back in those days. So basically you tell the lender what you make. They would trust your word on that and they would give you a loan to buy a home. So that has changed significantly, and that all of the documentation is required. The, you know, the lenders all, you know, typically abide by the same type of guidelines. You've got to have 2 years of tax returns that you have to prove over to the lender. And, you know, the process has gotten a lot more in depth as far as the pre-qualification, but that also helps with a healthier market because if you have people who can truly afford a home, that's going to create stability in the marketplace.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to turn now to Denny Grimes from Denny Grimes & Company. You've been in business here for how many years?
34 years, exactly.
So you've seen the ups and downs.
I've seen a couple of them, yes.
Yeah, so you've been through this cycle. And I'm going to ask you, just because I'm kind of curious, having that experience, did you see 2008 coming?
Well, what's interesting is actually the market peaked, and David was right when he talked about, you know, the inventory kind of peaked in 2005, and that's when the median sales price on the existing home, and I'm going to be speaking on existing homes, which is the resales predominantly, unlike David's, really they track new home construction. Mm-hmm. The market kind of peaked in December 2005 at $322,000, and what was interesting is, and I give a speech every year, is that I would love to be able to say I saw it coming. However, a lot of people in the industry had feelings like something was coming. You know, it's kind of like, you know, before they had barometers, people's bones would ache because of the change in pressure. Well, there were signs looking back that this was coming, and some people predicted it. They just didn't know when. It's kind of like, you know, they've been predicting the Cubs would win the World Series. It just took 100 years. So the issue is that everyone kind of, many people, I should say, saw it coming. No one predicted the depth of it. And basically, when the market crashed in December 2005 was the peak, and it did not bottom. till 2009, summer of 2009, and you see a median sales price go from $322,000 to $79,800. That is a tsunami of biblical proportions in the market. And as Brad was saying, it's good to be on the phone with these guys. Brad's my neighbor, and of course, I've done a lot of work with Metro Studies, so hello, you guys. You know, since that time in 2007, 8, and 9, you know, in 2009, 4, it has started to climb, and it has been very rational since. So in a word, and I had a feeling in my bones, and I said at Market Watch, you know, you guys, this is not going to go on forever. I got a lot of hate mail for it. So I think everyone saw. They just didn't know it would be this bad.
Yeah. So, well, how do you feel about the slow, steady climb in pricing? And there are people, you know, once you see these values go back up, they get concerned that maybe we're in for another wild ride down the other side of the roller coaster again.
Yeah, well, there are no signs on the horizon that any kind of bubble is building because, you know, the sales have been rational. Price growth has been rational since 2009. In fact, it's quite flat both in Lee and Collier counties, and this is what's given the new home builders a little bit of indigestion because, you know, they're having to search for price point. When you look at, for example, you know, you get a lot of national articles that talk about how we are back or above pre-bubble pricing, et cetera. Well, that's the country. It's not us. You know, basically, our prices are flat. And you can't have a bubble if you don't have irrational price growth. You can't have a bubble unless you have an investor or a speculator-driven market. And right now, it's basically user-driven. So, and like Brad said, the lending has calmed down a little bit. So you actually have to qualify nowadays to get a loan. So there are no indications of any kind of the heated up market we had before that would lead to a bubble.
So one of the problems that we talked about just briefly a second ago was the issue of stagnant wage growth. Do realtors, you know, keep an eye on what the wages are and that kind of affordability of homes?
So I think, yes, I mean, that's going to be, I mean, our market has been fed by boomers. And again, they kind of lulled us into believing, you know, particularly when they said the 80 million baby boomers are going to be retired, we were going to get 10 million. And so that was going to be the continued growth of our market. And now what we're seeing is that even baby boomers are somewhat concerned about the cost of living. And once that type of market peters out or dries up, then basically, or even the people that buy the boomers' houses in Rockfield, Illinois, they're concerned about wages. So really, what's going on with the economy now with a lower unemployment, increased job growth, that is going to be a great shot in the arm for long-term real estate stability.
Uh-huh. And let me ask you a little bit about rental costs. Do you deal with any kind of rentals, or do you know much about that market?
I think Brad and I probably, you know, touch around that a lot because a lot of people would like to own, and they can't afford to own, so they rent. And I can tell you that we kind of work the same market. And, Brad, you can speak to this, is that generally you find a nice rental, it's gone, and there is upward pressure on pricing.
That's for sure. So we have a property management division of our brokerage, and we have seen, you know, it's really followed the same trend as real estate pricing and actually in a lot more aggressive of a way. So some years we're seeing, you know, 20% year-over-year increase in rental prices. And, you know, the landlord is aggressive with it, you know, because they're, you know, they're wanting to stay with the market, and that puts a big squeeze on tenants, you know, the working class. It does put a pretty big squeeze on them.
Tell me about millennial buyers. Are you seeing many millennials looking towards buying instead of renting because they don't see the value in putting money into a renting situation?
Especially
when they're so high.
Yes, millennials are buying, but waiting until later, you know, the early late 20s, early 30s millennial. Okay, so it's one of those factors that they're making sure that they have the job lined up, they've got everything comfortable, and you know, before they're jumping in. And kind of the same thing goes for relationships with millennials too. So, you know, waiting, pushing the marriage off, pushing the possibility of children off, and pushing the initial home ownership off a little bit later in life.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about real estate during this part of today's show, and my guests are Denny Grimes from Denny Grimes and Company, Brad Dohack with Gulf Point Properties, and David Cobb. He's the regional director for South Florida for Metro Study. You can join join our conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, David Cobb, with Metro Study, you mainly focus on new homes. Is there much in the way of is there much consideration given to the millennial buyer when it comes to new home builds?
Well, in our local market here, 40% of our population is over 55, and a lot of our home sales are imported wealth from the Midwest and the Northeast, you know, baby boomers, like Denny said, moving down. But when you look at it nationally, you look at the millennial picture, they're now the largest population cohort at 80 million. There's more of them than there are baby boomers now. And a couple of years ago, their home ownership rate was only about 30%. Today, it's 36. That's a pretty big jump in 2 years. And when you compare that to the millennials or the baby boomers that would have been 25 to 35 years old back in the mid-'80s to early 90s, the home ownership rate for them back then was 38%. So they're only 2% off. And when you look at the type of households that are being formed, either rental or owned, during the recession, it was all rental growth in the household. People were getting kicked out of their houses. You know, the millennials were getting out of college and renting apartments. In the last couple of quarters, it's been positive on the owner side. And this is this first wave of millennials that are now beginning to hit their peak earning years. They're paying off their student debt. You know, they're becoming their ability to buy a home now is real.
Now they're adulting.
And they're adulting.
That's
they just
what they
did
call
it.
It
about, yeah. They just did it about 10 years later, you know, than a lot of us. But this is going to be, at least on a national perspective, the next big group of home buyers, both new and resale, will be the millennials. And they're moving into it in a big way. We're going to see this happen over the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And so what I was going to say, David, from your perspective with new construction, in my experience, millennials are, you know, new construction is very appealing to a millennial. You know, that is a, they would much prefer to have something brand new. It has a warranty instead of, you know, quote unquote, used home. So what is your take on that as far as the millennial, as far as millennials go?
Yeah, I think also, you know, millennials tend to be a little more aware socially of our natural resources and things like that. And we're seeing that they aren't as impressed with the big 3,000 square foot home. They just want to own something. In fact, the city of Miami just passed an ordinance decreasing the size of a dwelling unit to 297 square feet. And so I think you're going to see, especially in these urban areas that are close to transportation hubs where you don't really need a car, I think, you know, there's going to be a wave of some small housing, mostly
tiny
attached,
homes.
Tiny homes being built that millennials and frankly empty nesters of any age group are going to eat these up. You'll see this happen.
I wonder if we're going to see any baby boomers want to, you know, recapture their youth and act like millennials and want to get into these smaller places like this.
A lot of them are downsizing. You know, a lot of – in fact, I'm sure Denny and Brad can attest to this, that a lot of the folks that are moving down here from up north are moving out of bigger homes and into smaller homes. And they're particularly like the lock-and-leave type home, right, the twin villa and the carriage homes and the coach homes where if they're going to just be a winter resident, they come down here and they don't have to worry about the maintenance of the outside when they're not here.
Yeah, the baby boomers are more – they're more interested in lifestyle. So they're buying lifestyle. And so as far as, you know, if I sold my home up north and I'm coming down, you know, here full time, as long as I have room for, let's say, some grandkids to come and visit, then I'm good. You know, that's as far as the home itself is concerned.
And a community pool for them to go play in.
Among other things,
yeah.
Right? There's movie theaters and, you know, pickleball is a big thing these days. I mean, the lifestyle portion of this is what's most important to that baby boomer.
And Denny Grimes, I wanted to ask you also, have you seen any impacts from Hurricane Irma impacting your business as far as, you know, now all the old homes are kind of new again because they're being rebuilt from the inside out for a lot of people. Did you see any impacts?
Yeah, actually, you don't see it yet. We will. I actually did a TV spot a few weeks after Irma, and I said, and they asked me the same question, if we're going to see an impact. I said, yes, it's going to help our market. And the reason is that when people think of hurricane and hurricane damage, and I heard today on the news channel is that the number one search engine, Google search engine topic for the all of 2017 was Hurricane Irma. So a lot of people had interest. They watched that. However, they hear Hurricane Irma hitting Southwest Florida, and their mind says they have mental images of Puerto Rico. And so obviously when they come down here, they're going to see that, yes, you know, because of new building codes, et cetera, and stricter building codes, that were a whole lot nicer than they anticipated. And they'll see that, you know, a hurricane, as terrible as it sounds from the north, when you're here, it is survivable. And I remember back when I was in real estate, when Andrew hit, and of course they had and David and those people in new construction talk about the different layers of new codes that came on, and builders were weeping and gnashing their teeth. However, that's the type of thing that would is going to help us. So when they come down here, they're going to see that, you know what, this is a whole lot nicer than I thought. I can't even tell it happened. So I think that's going to be a real plus. However, if I can add, you know, people are searching for this neck of the woods, so to speak, Southwest Florida, for three things: water, warmth, and way of life. And the water coming from the sky will never be a challenge for us. It's going to be the water coming out of the lake. And that's going to be that is the thing that I'm most concerned about, is that because there is a pipeline in the decision-making process. Some may come down to rent. They may vacation here. And if they come down here and they experience, you know, at the wrong time where they see the lake discharge, they can't let their kids go swimming, they have nixed Southwest Florida off their list to consider to come down and buy. So that is the only thing on the external environment that I really watch, and I want people to know that can affect our long-term real estate market.
Yeah, I understand. So you're talking about the Lake Okeechobee discharges that send fresh water down into the Gulf and end up turning the Gulf waters a wonderful shade of root beer.
Root beer, yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. Root beer.
Or chocolate milk.
Yeah, chocolate milk sometimes too. Yeah, and then, you know, wherever you stand on environmental issues, it is also going to be a pocketbook issue if, like you say, there are people that come down here on vacation to see what they think of the neighborhood, if they want to buy or not. So I understand what you're saying. Brad, I wanted to ask you one of the similar question there. Did you see impacts from Irma yet? Have you seen anything?
What's interesting is that we have seen inventory actually come down a bit. So at this point, and
could that be because people have to finish repairs before they put it on the market?
Absolutely. So, you know, if you're trying to get a screen repaired right now, you know, good luck. The screening companies are having, you know, major shortages on supplies. There was a lot of trees down, and some of them, you know, may have hit a home. That needs to be repaired. And so what's happening is a lot of inventory has come off of the market, especially in Collier County. I would expect, as is our, you know, very seasonal market that we have here, that in January that inventory will come back as it typically does. But that has, you know, reduced the number of homes that are available.
Has that pushed up prices a little bit? Has it nudged upwards?
No. So, you know, we're still seeing that steady year-over-year growth. That's what's happening. So it hasn't, you know, Collier County, if we're looking at single-family homes, up about 10% year-over-year. Lee County, a little over 6%.
How long do you have to have low inventory in homes to have that price nudged upward because of a lack of homes on the market?
So to see significant appreciation,
yeah.
If we're not at risk. Let's just put it that way. You know, it would take many months of people vying for homes and multiple bid offer, you know, multiple bid situations. And we're just not at that point. We're, you know, very much a six months of inventory is what we would consider equilibrium in the market. And Lee County's just under that. Collier County's just over that number. So, you know, it's very healthy from that perspective.
Right. And David, I wanted to ask you also, did the hurricane have any impact on new home building? Did that just slow it down? I mean, did that appreciably impact the numbers?
Well, certainly in September it did. I mean, September was pretty much a bust in terms of sales, closings getting pushed back. The builders I spoke with earlier today all mentioned that they had a rebound in sales in October and November from September, and that they were on plan. So especially in the affordable price spectrum, the new home builders are doing fine, and the recovery is back in terms of sales. Now, on the production side, it's a little bit of a different story because, we had a lumber tariff enacted in September. So plywood prices, for example, are up 15% year-over-year. Material costs in the local market here are scarce in the obvious areas, roofing and pool cages and perhaps drywall and a few other products. So builders' costs are going up. And their labor situation has been further aggravated because there's probably 30 to 40,000 homes at least that have been damaged in some way by the storm. And that's sapping off some of the labor that they would depend on to get the homes built. So they're seeing their cycle time in construction maybe go out a little bit, and some uncertainty on pricing is there. Now, I don't think the builders, as Denny had mentioned, the our pricing on the new home side has been either flat or down over the last couple of years. Flat in Collier and down a little bit in Lee, based on closing data. So there's not a lot of pricing, pressure that the or pricing power that the builders have to raise prices to combat these increase in costs. So they're getting pushed up from both ends there.
So I want to close out the show by asking all three of you what your feelings are on a bubble. Are we facing a bubble? Is it one that we can't see until it pops? So I'm going to just I'll start with you, David. Do you see? Do you feel like we're in a bubble? Because people are a little bit gun shy now that the prices are continuing to go up.
Well, first of all, the table has been set already for the next downturn in the housing market. And the reason for this is low interest rates that have allowed people to buy more house than they normally would. I mean, we are at historical lows for mortgage rates. And mortgage rates are not tied to the Fed rate, even though the Fed's raised their rates 1.25% over the last year or so. Our mortgage rates didn't go up. The reason is mortgage rates are tied specifically to inflation. We haven't had any of that, for years. That's the specter. That's the little thing that's lurking under the hood is if we have inflation, mortgage rates go from, say, 4 to 6%, almost every market in the country will be overvalued by 20%. Now, we've seen that a little bit here already just with the supply-demand situation where prices have flattened out and have fallen a little bit here. We won't have a 2008 again because the supply is so constrained across this country. What you'll see is falling prices to a point where they meet equilibrium in the market and we recover. It won't be anything like what we just experienced 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But the table's been set. All we need is inflation and we're in trouble.
Brad, what do you foresee? Do you fear that we're in a bubble situation?
So let me bubbles are that's a strong word.
I know it's a strong word. It's scary, but
yeah,
that's what people are literally afraid of.
Healthy markets correct, right? So just because a market could potentially correct doesn't mean that we'd be in a bubble. We're a very healthy market. Are we due for some type of correction? Perhaps. And one of the key figures that we watch is median time to contract. So what that means is the amount of time that a home from the date that it's listed until the date that it receives a contract for sale. And we've seen that number go up, quite significantly. So year over year in Collier County, that is up 34.5%. So now it, median time frame is nearly 4 months that it takes from the moment that you list your home for sale until that sells. And so as that time goes on, technically, if you have a motivated seller, they would then potentially have price reductions. Again, very healthy market, but do we see prices appreciating, like they have over the past 8 years straight? Probably not.
Yeah. And Denny Grimes on the phone, I wanted to throw it to you for the last comment. Would you agree that we're maybe due for a correction but not a bubble bursting?
Yeah. When David said the table's set, the table's set about every 7 to 9 years for a real estate cycle correction. So, just piggybacking on what David and what Brad said, bubblers, there is no chance. It's a better chance the Bucks will win the Super Bowl than we're going to have a real estate bubble. So that's not going to happen. However, we're already seeing the market start to correct. And if I just really quick, I'll say I don't really believe in a buyer's market or a seller's market. There's really a buyer segment and a seller segment. When you look at the sweet spot of our market, Lee County, basically our prices have been flat. January, the median was 241. It's 240 and basically in the fourth quarter. So there's no change. Collier's actually down a little bit. However, when you look at the sweet spot market in Lee County, it's 300 and down. There's upward pressure on the prices there. The upper price ranges are stagnating and actually retracting. That's the same also in Collier County. So as the people listen to this, if you happen to be a buyer stepping into the sweet spot in new construction or existing, you have to act quickly because there's upward pressure there. The upper price ranges are already starting to correct, and I think that's what's really retarding and the numbers a little bit and showing that we don't have as much price growth as we probably do. So there's two markets, really. There's those the sweet spot, which is the haves, and the ones that are the have-nots. So sellers in the sweet spot market, you're going to get your price probably. If you're above that, you're going to have to capitulate or grab a Snickers because it's just not going to happen very fast.
Grab a Snickers. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much. I want to thank all of our guests. Brad Dohack is a qualifying broker of Gulf Point Properties in Fort Myers. Brad, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
David Cobb is the regional director for South Florida with Metro Study. David, thanks to you as well for coming back on the show.
Thank you. See you next quarter.
And also Denny Grimes from Denny Grimes & Company. Thanks for taking a bit of time out of your vacation in Mexico to join the conversation today. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Coming up, we're joined by an FGCU professor of economics for a discussion about boom-bust cycles in general. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We were just exploring the real estate market and whether or not we're possibly approaching or even beginning to enter another bubble. Turns out the three people that we were talking with think not. And we did a show just a few weeks ago with when Bitcoin was worth about $8,000. And since then, it's more than doubled to over $17,000 as of this moment. So we thought we'd spend a few minutes exploring bubbles and boom-bust economic cycles. I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Wesley. He is the director of the Regional Economic Research Institute and professor of economics here at Florida Gulf Coast University. Professor Wesley, thanks for coming in today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back on the show. So
thanks.
Can you define for me what an economic bubble is?
A bubble occurs when one sector of the economy shows a market increase in prices, usually a really quick one, and it seems to be narrowed to that particular industry or area of the economy. It could be an industry. It could be a geographic region as well.
Okay. So do you watch these?
Oh, yeah. I've studied them for a long time.
Do they happen frequently?
Well, I mean, you can go all the way back to the tulip bubble back in Holland in the 17th century. That's considered to be the biggest bubble, although I just saw a Drudge Report headline where it said that the Bitcoin
has eclipsed the tulip
is now the biggest one in history. I don't know if that's going to end up being true or not. But
So take me back to the tulip moment, and that was actually kind of why we thought about doing this story. We were talking about Bitcoin, and I said, oh, my gosh, it's like tulip mania. And the newsroom looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I was like, somewhere in some cobweb corner of my brain, I remembered this story. So tell us
about
it.
That's the good part of your brain, okay?
So not where the 80s song lyrics
are.
<Yeah.
laughs> Well, a bubble occurs. There's no reason why there should ever be a bubble if some monetary authority is not pumping more and more money into the economy. And sometimes it's going to have an effect on a specific industry. And I can go through cases about that. But with respect to the situation in Holland, what happened was that the number one export of Holland was, and still an important one, are the tulips. And a lot of the money that was being – the Bank of Amsterdam was – had switched to a system surreptitiously, which would be very close to what we would call a fractional reserve banking system today. And it had the effect of vastly increasing the money supply there. It was very a fraudulent activity whenever that happens, because traditionally banks would issue money or currency based upon some existing supply of usually metal, gold or silver. And if they printed any more money above that amount, that would be considered engaging in fraud. And that's pretty much what the Bank of Amsterdam did. And so you had general increases in prices, and then a lot of that money became centered on a specific industry, which was the tulip industry. And I don't have the numbers with me, but I mean, you had like 1,000% increases in the prices of tulips. Your 5 years' wages went to purchase a flower, and they were unique flowers. They're not like there's your typical flower, but still,
tulips are great. But I mean, 5 years' wages for a bulb.
Yep, it was a lot of money went towards these purchases, and that's why that's considered one of the biggest bubbles.
It's kind of putting like a really almost obscene value on something. You know,
well,
it's just that's a ton, and that happened with tulip bulbs, and then throughout the history.
I think the finance literature has a saying of like the greater fool theory. Do you ever hear of the greater fool theory?
No, I'm not familiar because I probably am one.
Yeah. They say that if something's going up, the worst purchase is you might purchase something as overvalued, but you'll still purchase it because you'll think someone else will buy it from you later at a higher price. So there's always a greater fool willing to make that purchase. And that's something we see a lot in bubble-like sectors of the economy. So
we're thinking then that Bitcoin is another bubble.
Well, back up a little bit. I think everyone agrees that we had a real estate bubble in the United States.
Yes.
After 9/11 and the years following that. And remember, that came from an unprecedented increase in the money supply given the Fed's policies from 2002 to 2004. Okay. So a lot of that money went into the housing sector. Since 2008, we've had another unprecedented increase in the money supply with QE1, QE2, and you know what I'm talking about with that?
No.
We also had unprecedented expansions of the money supply since the recession of 2008 and 2009. So we would expect – I would certainly expect some sectors of the economy to show characteristics of bubbles. If you're not increasing the money supply, there's no reason why a bubble should grow out of hand. You might find some sectors growing faster than other sectors, but if you're not increasing the money supply, by definition, other sectors would have to contract in response to that, because there's any money you spend on the bubble sector is money you're taking away from other sectors, so it should balance each other out. But if you're printing money, that doesn't necessarily have to happen.
So as an economist, can you see a bubble coming then?
Usually no, and they're very hard to predict. And
so you have to wait till they pop?
Usually we talk about them after the fact. You go, wow, that was a bubble. Or once they become obvious, it looks like this is a bubble right now.
Okay.
And then some economists were saying back in 2006 that, well, real estate's in a bubble. But a lot of other prominent economists were saying, no, this is not a bubble. This is just the market.
So looking at Bitcoin right now, people are still saying, go out and buy it. This is a thing.
The greater fool.
What will correct that then? So what makes that correct eventually when everybody decides I'm not the greater fool?
Well, investors might decide it's gotten too high and pull back can happen. I mean, Bitcoin is an interesting situation to look at. I mean, at least with housing, there's some scarce – well, there's a scarce amount of Bitcoin too. Usually what happens though is investors realize that prices are getting too high and then they pull back and then the bubble pops, or the inflating of the currency stops and that also causes it to pop. So but in both of the, all of these cases, the real value of the asset is hidden by inflation.
Well, and then in this case, we're dealing with something that's different in that it's also kind of an intangible.
Yeah, the thing about Bitcoin is when you buy Bitcoin, you're buying nothing is the thing. And at least if you're buying real estate or tulips, you actually have some physical good. Even if the market crashes, you might still own a real good, which is some assurance. But with Bitcoin, I mean, you're buying what? A piece of a computer code or memory on a computer. You're buying a piece of e-money.
Yeah. So, I mean, even if you only get 10 cents for your tulip bulb later, it's still a thing that's there.
Yeah, you actually have some real asset.
Yeah, it's just It's definitely a horse of a different color, this one. There are economic theories that claim to be able to ensure that we don't have boom-bust cycles. Are there any of those around?
Well, you would have to argue. Well, I think I've alluded to it earlier. When you have a system in which the money supply is stable or it grows at a stable and predictable rate, you tend to have fewer bubbles in the economy, as opposed to if you're constantly pumping new money into the economy, especially during or in the aftermath of a recession, then you're more likely to see bubbles come up.
Well, there have been things put in place, you know, where you can't just print money because you want to print money. Like you mentioned, you said earlier, you can't just start throwing money into the economy. It's illegal.
Well, you can if you have the legal right to, which is the government. That's what the government does. I mean, I was thinking about this with the current budget deal, which is going on. The government announces some annual budget they want to spend, and then they raise some money to pay for it through taxes. They also raise money to pay for it through debt. Okay, and then the remainder is just printed inflation, just on that goes at it, and so that's how it happens. But you're right. I mean, I just can't. I can't create a legal tender currency willy-nilly. It's called counterfeiting.
Well, yeah, there's that too. Yeah. I don't have a printing machine that does that. Well, we're going to have to take another quick break, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Christopher Wesley. He's the director of the Regional Economic Research Institute and professor of economics at Florida Gulf Coast University. Dr. Wesley, we appreciate your time today.
Hey, thank you.
Up next, we're going to discuss the ways to prevent isolation and abuse of our aging population. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU.